Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the opportunity to continue the discussion. I'll kick off with a few questions myself, and then really the point is for you guys to ask questions, and I'll try to moderate the traffic here. So please think of questions you would like to ask. I would like you to when you ask a question, to start with stating who you are and which company you represent, and then we can go to the questions. And just to refresh your mind, right? So we saw three great presentations. The first with Andy, mostly about a new way of working in an industry in a company that has been around for almost 125 years. Then Jason shared about the impact of automation, particularly in trading and commercial. And then Professor Prowse on the bigger societal questions about what does it all mean and what do we actually want from all of this. So let me ask the questions in that order as well. So Andy, as having been around for 125 years, my guess is that a lot of your workforce has been around maybe not quite 125 years, but decades in your organization. So can you describe the journey, how you got your existing workforce who was used to a different way of working on the journey into your new way of working?
Yeah, thank you. It's really interesting. And just to give you some context, around about 50% of our workforce are Gen Y and younger already. So that gives you some kind of idea of the generational split that we have. Look, it's really interesting. You go into a completely different way of working and you kind of make assumptions that certain people will be naturally aligned to that and adapt to it quicker, and other people will be slower because they're older and they're used to doing things a different way. Our experience was quite interesting in that what we actually found, and I'll clean this up because there was some bad language in it, but one of our baby boomer colleagues, as we were going through the transformation to the agile way of working, and said, "There's nothing new here, mate. This is how we used to sort of work, you know, 20, 30 years ago." And I think that was absolutely spot on, because what's happened over time is that organizations have gone through cycles of mass centralization and different models where we've created sort of functional specialisms where people, you know, they're actually anti-collaboration and they create silos. So actually by removing those and going back down to a more multidisciplinary approach is actually nothing particularly new. So what we actually found that a lot of our, older colleagues, and that's probably not the right terminology, actually adapted to this really, really easily. There were probably people in every single generation that sort of struggled with it, and in every generation that actually embraced it. So I think the important thing is that we did recognize everybody's starting position and created an organizational change management strategy that helped everybody through that transition. But it's not for everybody, and inevitably some people decided that it wasn't a model they wanted to work in, but equally we found that it's been incredibly attractive to other people wanting to come and join the organization who are attracted to working in a far more sort of collaborative modern environment.
Thank you, Andy. Quite insightful. And on the point of attracting new talent, Jason, you were mentioning that graduates might not immediately think of CBAs as a, I think you used the word, sexy place to work. So keen to hear, how did you attract the new generation to join you and your team?
I think, of course, agriculture's gone through a lot of change and we've seen deregulation of the agricultural industry. That has attracted some people, but I think it's more about, you know, our job descriptions, being more open as a company to people outside of the agricultural industry. And what we have seen is that's actually attracted more and more people from different, not only different countries and different races, but also, you know, even within Western Australia, we've had a lot of people from different sectors. And that's really starting to broaden us out in terms of our skill base.
Thank you. And then Professor Pauls, you mentioned the big questions, right? So technology can be good, can be bad. It's important for us to decide what it is that we want technology to solve. What's the role of state and federal regulators for that?
Yeah, I think one of the first opportunities, I was saying, here in Western Australia, we don't have a Privacy Act, but that actually is a tremendous opportunity because we can learn what has worked and hasn't, importantly. But also emboldened enforcement officers. So as part of something like a Privacy Act, you get a Privacy Commissioner who can work with an information commissioner, who can do investigations and so on. But I think we need a lot more joined up work between regulators. So one of the reasons the European bloc has been able to successfully challenge some of the global dominance of the tech players is because it works across different regulatory authorities and they take a lead on different aspects of investigation. So in some of the challenges around companies like Uber, I think, there's not a lot of joined up work. So that would be a key opportunity.
Thank you. Let's go to the audience. Who would like to ask a question?
Oh, hello, Rob Corey from Bankwest. I'm just interested to ask the panel, what do employers need to do to keep Generation Y informed and inspired and motivated in the workplace?
Jason, you want to take a first stab at that?
Well, I think a couple of key things is obviously how do you reduce some of those mundane tasks that, you know, in their roles. I think it's also about, you know, what sort of environment that they like in the office. And we've just moved CBH from West Perth to St. George's Terrace and, you know, we've gone absolutely open plan. Even the CEO is open plan. And that allows a lot of the Gen Y to be able to come and approach him and sort of talk to him about what's happening. And, you know, I think it's more about people want to have a lot... My feeling is people want to have a lot more openness in an office environment and they want that ability to be able to move around and talk to as many people, regardless of where they are in the, I guess, in the ranking, you know, in the structure.
And then, Andy, if I could ask you this question to you with a little bit of a mean edge, maybe, because a lot of the research that we see is that for the new generation, the purpose of what you're doing and the purpose that a company has is a lot more important than in previous generations.
Look, rather controversially, I don't think it's actually that different. I think, you know, for those people that have read Daniel Pink's book about, you know, motivation and surprising things around what motivates individuals, it is around autonomy, mastery, and purpose. I think everybody comes to work if they see, hear, and believe in a higher purpose to what they're doing day to day. I think that's a big motivational push for anybody, whether they're Gen Y, Gen X, or Generation Alpha. I think empowering people to be able to make more decisions themselves and also enabling people to become masters at what they're good at. I think what organizations inevitably try to do is to, and I'm sure we've all had those performance reviews where we go, you know what, Andy, you're really good at this, but you're not so good at this, so I want to build a development plan around this thing you're not very good at. And all that does is make you mediocre in something that you're never going to be excellent in. So, you know, to me, why aren't we doubling down on development activities for people what they're already good at? You know, and I just don't think enough organizations are wired in that way. So to me, you know, giving that clear sense of purpose, enabling and pushing more decisions and more empowerment into lower levels of the organization who really understand how things work, and then enabling people to be the best at what they're already good at, I think goes a long way to both attracting and retaining the talent that you have.
Thanks, Andy. It's not a second time that you take a very countered generational view on things, right? So that's refreshing to hear. There's a question in the back.
Hi, Laura Crowe from Hudson. Andy, you mentioned flexibility at Bankwest. Can you tell me what that looks like?
So there's a number of levels on that. So we have flexible working, which enables people to work from home. And in some of our areas, that's over 50%. And a lot of our processing teams, for example, we give people the technology to be able to work remotely. There are obligations that we put in place before people can take advantage of that, but that's been phenomenally successful for us and for people that have lifestyles that mean that it's hard for them to travel, you know, into the city and work, you know, 7-8 hours, and they can work from home and organize that around their personal lives. That's been fantastically successful. But even in the office itself, you know, it's an AB activity-based working environment, which is totally flexible. You don't have a fixed desk. You can sit anywhere within the building, so you can work with the people that you need to work with on whatever you're working with on that particular period. So yeah, it's got many levels, but we believe that again, in the environment that we're operating within, giving the freedom of choice for individuals, because I think ultimately that's what we mean by flexible working, giving people the freedom of choice in terms of where they want to work and the way they can do it is unbelievably important to us, and therefore that's why it's been a big strand of our people's strategy.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Emma Harris from Rio Tinto. Question for the panel. In the context of the future of work and generations, what do you think, in your experience, are some of the myths that we actually need to bust?
Professor Bowles, you want to take a first stab at that?
It's often interesting the projections that are made about young people in the workplace, young people around technology in an educational context. For example, I think immersive experiences, applied learning, but also face-to-face learning is always what students want more of, and yet often we sort of have a push towards more tech-mediated experiences. I think they can be complemented, so you can play to the best of both affordances, so you can do pre-video learning and so on, but then have really engaged classroom experiences. So, yeah, the other one that is always that young people don't care about privacy, but in fact they have incredibly sophisticated strategies around how they mask their identities, which we can all learn a lot from. So yeah, it's often just myths about young people, I think, that are quite disconnected from the evidence.
And Jason, do you have a myth that you needed to bust to build your team?
I don't have a myth, but I think something that is reasonably important, and I think what Julia was saying is right, but you know, I guess the question is do we go too far with the use of technology and we actually come back more to personal one-to-one facing, you know, meetings and workplaces? And I think, you know, we have, I guess, tried what Andy has done at Bankwest, and it seems very successful, people working at home and having very flexible hours. In some cases, we've learnt that that actually doesn't work and that actually teams need to be together. Now, that's not in every role, and certainly different industries have different views on this, but we have seen actually, we've tried to swing one way and actually in some cases, it doesn't work. So there are some differences, and I think person to person or team building environment where it's actually together does help a lot. And we notice that with our international offices, et cetera, et cetera.
And leaving my moderator role for one second to answer your question from some of the research that we have done, there's two myths that spring to mind. First is that automation and the new way of working is not something that is limited to a particular skill group or particular age group, right? Some people think it's only the people without a university degree or something. That's not at all true, right? It has not much to do with the sophistication of the job that you're doing. The second is that automation hits almost all jobs, but not in equal measures. But it's not the whole job that is going to be impacted. It's a component of everybody's job, right? And then if you stitch it all together, you can paint a future where some of the mundane repetitive work, which allows itself for pattern recognition, as you mentioned, will be done by computers, which allow people to interact and to think, what does it actually mean, right? So that will be the optimistic way forward.
But I just had a quick myth. I think in the context, it's very easy in the context of the changes that we're seeing globally, to think that, you know, everything will become digital. And I think one of the big myths that we could talk about from our perspective is that people, you know, would prefer digital experience to human interaction. That's certainly not the case. Certainly people want more frictionless, seamless experiences, but they absolutely, in our experience anyway, certainly want human interaction, and particularly moments of truth. So I think that's one of the biggest myths that I think in the when we talk about digital disruption and the change that's coming, that I don't think that's ever going to diminish. It might change, but it's never going to go away.
The next CEDA event will still be in person. Good. There was a question over there.
David Wolf from CBH. Perhaps a question for Julia. How is the university sector evolving to help prepare young people for the future of work, and how does it need to evolve further?
You know, I was thinking about Andy's comment about sort of training everyone, including in areas that might not be their strength. And I think there's a sort of latent recognition that a total STEM push isn't necessarily what we need to adapt to a technological future. There have been massive donations in the last couple of weeks into areas like ethics of artificial intelligence, into the humanities, into sort of more engagement with core scientific and technological advances from other disciplines. And I think finding a language to work together, I have worked across computer science and law for the last 5 years, and it's incredibly difficult to find sort of a common language and way of speaking. But I think that's one of the aspects that we need to teach both from both sides of the equation. I think there's a lot going through a number of changes at UWA around how to make sure that we continue to have engaging educational experiences. As I said, I think it absolutely is a combination of making the most of when you can deliver in-person experiences and then how you can assist it with technology. But new areas, there's a whole new applied science, I think, around how we deal with technological change. And Australia's got some real leaders in it, in Melbourne, ANU and here. And so sort of thinking through outside our traditional disciplinary boundaries is, I think, also a real opportunity.
Again, if you allow me to add, we look quite deep into this in New Zealand. So you can ask yourself whether New Zealand is similar to Australia or not. But there we saw that the speed with which universities change is not as fast as the speed with which the needs of the industry change. So a lot of good things are happening in terms of raw numbers. Universities, not only universities, but also TAFE and the equivalent, are not churning out the people at the volumes yet that you would want, right? So there's a bit of a lag there.
Nick Bates from the Brand Agency. My question's for Andy, and it's around productivity. So moving to an agile way of working is a big step for any organisation. Just interested in terms of the measures and objectives you put in place in terms of productivity to be gained from doing that and where that's ended up.
Yeah, really good question. So I'm glad you called out the productivity because it's important to stress because it sometimes gets forgotten about. The foundations of agile are from Lean Six Sigma discipline. So it is around elimination of waste. And if we think about the sort of software delivery lifecycle in terms of bringing new ideas and delivering them to give value to customers. Traditionally, there's a lot of waste in that process. So, you know, the model that we put in place, and I didn't get time to sort of really go through it in detail, but the essence is that you collapse all of your silos and you create multidisciplinary teams. So, you know, whether you come from a product specialism or a UX designer or a technology perspective, you work together permanently in a multidisciplinary team to actually take an idea and push that through out to your customers. So there's a number of measures that we've got around that. You know, clearly we have things like frequency of deployment. We also have lead time to change. So how long does the actual delivery lifecycle sort of, you know, shift? But fundamentally, this is a model which is aimed at driving value for our customers. So therefore, each of our squads within the model will also have very specific outcomes that they're looking to deliver for customers. You know, so whether that's in terms of, you know, better experiences or ease, there are measures around that. So there's internal measures. So are we actually delivering faster? Are we getting better outcomes for our customers? And also, are we reducing the number of systems incidents so that we could be going quicker? We could be delighting customers, but we're causing loads of risk incidents. So we have to obviously look at that as well. So it's sounds a bit of a cliche, but it is a balanced scorecard approach. But interestingly, they are a number of those measures are ones that weren't necessarily there pre-moving to this model. So it is very, very important.
Rachel.
Afternoon. Rachel Howard from McKinsey. I wanted to expand on the question about talent and if one of the findings is that we might not be churning out the volume of talent at the university or early education levels, what sort of challenges have you come across in building or finding the talent you needed in the new domains, and how did you go about, you know, plugging some of those gaps, and what might WA learn from your experience?
Jason, you want to take a first
Yeah, I think, you know, if I take in into the aspect of data science, for example, you know, we've pretty well had to find people from overseas or who, you know, may not be in this state. So I'm not necessarily saying that is because our education in terms of our universities isn't churning them out yet, but it's probably we needed them at a certain level to then be able to build the team underneath. So I think universities are starting to look through this. I mean, we now, even in our trading division, are looking for people more with mathematic ability or engineering, etc. So sort of taking them from a little bit to the left and right of where we would traditionally take them, say from agriculture, for example, or a commerce degree. So yes, and I think, you know, I think universities are responding. It does take time. You've got to get people attracted to these areas, and also you've got to get them through and with some experience. It's difficult to take people out of university, particularly when you're starting to build a team who have limited experience, particularly in something like data science.
And Andy, was it your experience as well that a lot of people came from outside, or did the majority of your kind of new roles come from internal people?
Look, it's a great question. Ultimately, where we landed is the vast majority of the roles within our new ways of working are filled by people that were already within the organisation. Some of that is because, and somebody pointed this out to me quite early in the journey, because as we were thinking about going down this route and speaking to other organisations that had done it and obviously reading up on things, you can easily fall into the trap of, well, you know, Andy's going to really struggle with that because he's dot, 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 dot. And somebody said to me, which was absolutely spot on, that how do you know that somebody's going to be effective or otherwise in this new way of working if they've never worked in that way of working? And that was really an important point for us, because it focused and forced us into the route that we really need to give people support in working in this new way of working rather than making assumptions based on the system that they were currently working within. Because if you've got an outdated, you know, heavily siloed, bureaucratic, non-collaborative work environment, then people aren't necessarily going to be at their best. So actually, by creating a new way of working, you're actually releasing people to achieve their full potential, and that's absolutely what we've seen. The other thing that I would add to that is that that's not to say that we haven't looked externally. We have, and we have recruited some really good capability to supplement what we have. But the reality is there aren't too many organisations that have actually gone down the route we've gone down. And what we actually found is that a lot of the finished article, if I can use that, actually didn't exist. And there was real scarcity globally. So there's really not a lot of choice, I don't think, other than to focus on upskilling, reskilling, and adapting the roles that your current employees have to actually be successful. And I'm really pleased that that's where we've ended up. I was mentioning to Christian before we started, if we'd relied on just bringing in all new people, we'd still be working at it now. There's absolutely no way we would have achieved it that way. And as a result, we've had a much better outcome for our colleagues who have largely really thrived on the new environment that we've created.
And Professor, you've been around outside Australia a lot as well. Is this experience typical outside Australia, or is this a uniquely Perth or WA view of the world?
It's interesting. I was most recently living in New York, and one thing in the university sector in the US is that there's a great awareness of the diversity challenge in who is in faculty, who's in, and then the recruitment processes. So I think there's actually a lot of systemic challenges in who has access to education and opportunities. With these new fields that are of, you know, decades old, it seems to me that it's actually a real opportunity to have more of a much broader pipeline of students coming in who have diverse experiences and backgrounds. In some of the areas that I've looked at around social applications of technology and implications, it's just such a richer conversation when you have people from different backgrounds. Some of the predictive analytics tools and the way that they intersect across different domains, from social welfare to immigration, is a very different experience for different people. And so it's a real challenge, and I think Australia's quite behind on kind of diversity and inclusion. It's a real challenge, something that we should put at the forefront, and as educators, it's it's core in my mind.
Any further questions from the room?
Hi, Kelly McKenzie from CBH Group. My question's for Andy. I imagine that the new work environment and the agile ways of working is heavily predominant in your office in the city here, but how have you made sure that you haven't created two separate cultures between that space and your branches?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So effectively, the way that the model works is that the teams that are based here in Perth, effectively working within the diagram that I showed in the presentation, are effectively delivering the tools and capabilities for the colleagues that are serving the customers. So getting the engagement right between the front line, I don't like that word, but the frontline colleagues within the model is absolutely critical. So there's actually a layer within the model that we call our sustainable change layer, and that actually is actually a function of the front line. So they're effectively the shock absorber of the stuff that gets developed and worked on through the agile model that we have, and translate that and regulate how that's rolled out to the front line. So it's not that we're creating two kind of organizations within one, it's actually part of one big ecosystem. Now, in addition to that, there are some subtle differences that the front line have, as well as the agile model that we have at the back behind the scenes, so to speak, but they're all based on a single set of organisational values and a single purpose for the organisation. So it actually works pretty well. One thing we haven't done is rolled out the full agile processes to everybody across the front line, because they already had very disciplined ways of working that were operating very effectively. And effectively, what we tried to do with this model is strip out the things that they don't really need to worry about. So I think fundamentally, if we'd had a different set of organisational values and different purpose, I think that would be a problem. But actually, the two things coexist very, very well.
I think it's over here.
Yes,
Emma Gibbons from CGM Communications. These questions are really great, and thank you so much for your answers. But I was wondering, how are you involving Gen Y and millennial workforce in the design of the workplace? Is there a reference group, or are there examples of research you're doing internally to reach out to that cohort?
In the design of the workplace, or just in the design of things that we do?
Both.
Both, yeah. I can give you a Bank West perspective. So I mentioned earlier, we have around about, depending on your definition of Generation Y, because people use different age ranges or year ranges, we're about 52% Gen Y already as an organisation. I'll give you one good example. I have a Gen Y individual who sits on my leadership team meetings, specifically to provide a context of whether the things that we talk about and when we talk about communication are actually going to resonate for that particular generation within the workplace. That's been really insightful and quite confronting. But I'd heartily recommend it if people haven't done that. When you think you're doing the right thing and explaining it in the right way, it's nothing more confronting than having somebody there that says, I don't know what you're talking about, that makes no sense to me or my cohort. So that's one aspect. Another activity that we did is that we actually got a whole group of Gen Y and younger colleagues with a selection of Baby Boomer and Gen X leaders into a room, and we framed a set of questions, which were basically stereotypical comments around Gen Y. Some of the sort of questions and things that we talked about today, and we first asked the baby boomers and the Gen X's to go to one end of the room depending on what they thought the answer was, and then obviously we asked the same question to the Gen Y and to see where they went, and it was quite insightful as to just how many of those myths that somebody else asked were borne out, which actually weren't founded in reality. So they're just a couple of examples of the types of things that we are doing. But as I say, because we've got a reasonable profile of Generation Y and younger within our squads, which are the teams that I showed earlier, that's how we look to ensure that we've got that good representation of what's really going to matter to our customers. And as I say, we've doubled down on our graduate recruitment intake. We're increasing that year on year because we see the value in getting that sort of diversity through the ages. But that's just a few examples.
Thanks, Andy. And Jason, how do you manage the inverted pyramid?
Look, I just give one example, and that's about, you know, us moving from a building we'd been in 20 odd years or whatever it was into St. George's Terrace, and really focused the actual team that put that together. Actually, Kelly McKenzie ran that team. We're pretty well all Gen Ys, and the way that it was set up and et cetera, was all really around that. And I think that really showed that, you know, a company like CBH was putting time into that. From a communication perspective, we are doing very similar things to what Andy is doing, is how do we bring Gen Ys into our communication strategies? What can they do to assist us in our communication? And we put a lot of time and effort into that as we move forward. And some of those, particularly in a trading aspect, some of those Gen Ys have large responsibilities. So we're listening to them naturally every day on what's happening in the market, the decisions they're making, the responsibility they have. So we're putting a lot of responsibility into their hands. And in fact, they're probably doing a better job than we are. So I think it's been really positive.
Thank you. There's a gentleman with a question. Sorry.
It's Fiona Bishop, Western Power. So my question is a bit about leadership here. When you have a really diverse bunch of people and you first put them together in a team, it can feel like you're holding a bunch of opposing magnets together. So in light of leading really diverse teams, what is any sort of tips or tricks that you have
I think around that? I can answer this one. You know, we have more than 11 nationalities and offices around the world, and you know, we've had a lot of experience. In fact, I lived in Indonesia and had some very good lessons on what not to do in this area. And you know, I guess we have people from Russians to Indonesians to Chinese working for us, and Japanese, and they have all different contexts. And not only, and some of them are Gen Y, X, et cetera. So you've got a lot of, I guess, you know, opposite magnets. And I think one of the things that we have really learned is to allow people to have an opportunity to speak. And I give you a classic example. We have some Indonesian ladies who work in our business who are fantastic, but they don't talk a lot unless you ask them a question. And their answers are always fantastic. And so it's about, instead of us dominating the conversation and putting our views across, it's always thinking about asking that person what their view is on these sort of things. So that's something that we've spent a lot of time. We've had a lot of clashes as a result because we've brought in a lot of cultures, but we've had to then, you know, I guess take the best pieces of every culture and try and mix them together. And we spend Chinese New Year, we celebrate the end of Ramadan, we celebrate all of the national holidays of the different countries to try and attract people. And from a different nationality perspective, that's been really good for us.
I'm really pleased you asked the question, because I think the single most important thing around driving greater diversity in any workplace is leadership, and that can be either the biggest support or it can be the thing that can just destroy it. So I think it's absolutely fundamental. One of the things that we did over the course of the last 12 months is we worked with an external company and we developed a virtual reality diversity training module, and effectively we put all of our leaders through that training, and effectively it, for those that have used virtual reality, it immersed the leader into real life scenarios the previous example, you know, people weren't getting listened to, or they were getting routinely talked over, or they weren't being invited to sort of contribute. And that was really confronting for a lot of leaders. And again, it's not a panacea. It's not going to solve everything. But it is so important that if you want to drive greater diversity and actually leverage the value from diversity, as I mentioned earlier, you have to have the leaders that embrace that that celebrate the different cultural events, but also recognize those cultural differences and actually get the best out of the diversity that you have. So that's just one example of how we're trying to tackle that.
One thought I had on the previous question, I think implicit in the challenge is how often we're willing to put, rather than just having consultation with Gen Y employees and so on, put them in leadership roles. I was involved, for example, in a in workplace design in a new campus development in New York, and ideas about how people preferred to work, which was in that case open plan, completely were misaligned with how people really wanted it, but it was too late. The building was built afterwards. And it ended up being, I think, an opportunity to then say, can we have some other processes where you actually are willing to have people lead? And I guess just to that other question, I personally have found that situations where I've responded best to leaders is where it's somebody who is on the inside and who may also sort of reflect the flaws of other employees and the challenges around life and work and backs you 100%. That's what my current leadership situation is. It's fantastic. I think it means that you feel like you're hitting the ground at the same level as others. That's often a challenge with, I think, a desire to import leaders rather than to find the champions, maybe the quiet champions in your own teams that really support everybody.
There's the last question all the way in the back.
Hi, my name's Gigi Petrie. I'm at Curtin University, the Future of Work Institute. I've heard a lot of questions today about Gen Y, in air quotes, Gen X, in air quotes. But actually, the largest growth that we're seeing in the labor pool is with mature workers. And that is going to be continuing for the next 30, 40 years and beyond. I'd like to know what your companies are doing or what you would recommend for attracting, retaining, and capitalizing on your mature workforce.
I'm happy to give that a crack. So, look, as I said, from a Bankwest perspective, we're already tipped over into, we now have more Gen Y than any other generation within the environment. But importantly, the role of the other generations is really, really important. I'll give you a couple of examples. So we've increased significantly our graduate intake. We actually buddy our graduates up with somebody from, one of the older generations, because in many ways, and I'm talking from a technology perspective, we've still got people in the organization that built a lot of our systems originally. And when graduates are coming in, they're actually wanting to understand how things were created and why we do things in the way we do. So actually giving some of the Generation X and Baby Boomers the opportunity to buddy up and mentor some of the Gen Ys has been phenomenally successful. And it makes them feel more valued, and that their experience and knowledge is being valued and reinvested into the next generation of the organisation. So that's really, really important to us. As I say, I look after technology, and within technology, we do have a pretty good spread of the generational gaps. Generational groups, and. Everybody that went through the change management experience that I mentioned earlier as we moved to the new ways of working was equally offered up to all of our existing colleagues as well as new colleagues. So, and we actually shaped and developed and matured some of the learning based on that input from the older generation. So very, very valued. There's just a couple of examples of what we're doing.
Thank you. Jason, do you want to give a succinct view?
Yeah, I think at CBH, we're actually celebrate people who have worked in the company for a long time. And we have some employees that have been there 40 plus years. So we actually do quite a bit to ensure that we retain mature and experienced people within the business. I think the challenge for us is attracting mature people into the business. So I think that's something that we probably need to think more about as we go forward, because we've been very good at retaining them, but probably we haven't really thought a lot about how do we attract them into the industry and into the business from something that, you know, outside of the agricultural industry.
Thank you. We have to close the session now. Unfortunately, the speakers will be available after the session as well for some further follow-up questions. Clearly, the topic of organizational design and workforce of the future raises a lot of energy. So thank you for all the spirited questions. And I would like to invite you to close the session, please.
Can we just have a round of applause for those guest speakers?